Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. This is Spectrum West for a Thursday, the 7th day of November already. Ice on the puddles today. Wow, that's a first. I'm Al Ross, and today we'll meet Dr. Ogden Rogers, chair of the Social Work Department at UW River Falls. He's written a book full of stuff he thinks about and things that have happened to him along the road of his very interesting career. The Oliver Report this week features Jim talking with Paul Kallenberg, who's directing the romantic comedy Almost Maine, playing through Saturday at the Harvey Hall Theater on the campus of UW-Stout. The Bridge to Hope is a location, a group of people, and a concept that works in Menominee, helping victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. Services coordinator Nicole Johnson will join the conversation. And if you're feeling a bit down that the growing season is gone and seems like forever before things poke their heads through the soil again, well, we have something to remind you that seasons go and seasons come. There is gardening and there is master gardening. Master gardeners are people who want to garden with more knowledge than just what's learned on the label of a pack of seeds or a weed killer. The master gardeners of the Eau Claire area are, as is the case all over America, tutored by people in county extension offices. Here, it's the UW Extension. And Aaron LaFave is a horticulture educator at the UW Extension office for Eau Claire County. Well, it seems as if I'm meeting more and more master gardeners all the time. The program must be going well.
Yep, the program has volunteers in it every year, new ones, and people stay in it for several years, and they enjoy the volunteer component as well as socializing with other gardeners in the area.
Uh-huh. Are you getting all age groups involved?
We typically get a retired age group. We are seeing some more interest in maybe like the 30-some age group. However, sometimes work commitments and family commitments get in the way of the training that we have. Mm-hmm. So, but typically retired.
How about men versus women?
Mainly women.
Mainly women. Yeah.
Mainly, but we do have men in the organization too.
Yeah, we've got to get those guys off their best intentions, and we need more male master gardeners.
Sure.
It's especially challenging to be a gardener or to garden at all in, you know, when you're in a zone four or whatever it is we are.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck do master gardeners do in the winter?
In the winter for the Eau Claire master gardeners, they do a winter garden seminar in February. And it attracts almost 150 people. So there's a lot of planning that goes involved in that during the winter months. And they do training. They do some training opportunities too. And then some people do presentations during the winter months, too, to get people prepared for thinking about spring.
Yeah. What is involved when someone contacts you or you put on a, you have certain, in fact, I just got an extension notice today. It says, Master Gardener Volunteer Training Offered.
And that must be mine.
That came from you, yes. Okay. So let's say someone says, all right, I want to be a Master Gardener. What's the process?
To be a Master Gardener Volunteer for extension, they have to do the training that's offered in the county, mm-hmm. and this year I'm doing a 13-week one. It's every other week, and they come in for about 3 hours at a time, and we learn all kind of the basics of gardening from trees, shrubs, lawn care, soil, working with youth gardens, school gardens, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the training's done, they do an open book exam that they pass. They also have to pass a background check because we work with delicate audiences or we work with youth and sometimes
sure.
disabled, and
okay.
so they have to pass that and fill out an application.
So is the training just all nuts and bolts, or do you talk philosophy too? Like, you know, gardening is a great hobby. It's good to be outdoors. There's a psychological benefit.
We do some therapeutic or horticulture therapy component to it, especially when you're working with, let's say, mentally challenged or physically challenged people or people who've gone through traumatic events. Some of those volunteer projects with those populations are very helpful to them. So we talk a little bit about that, but it is mainly kind of the nuts and bolts. And we also talk about how to volunteer, how to interact with youth, or how to answer questions from the public when they're in the office or at the Ask a Master Gardener booth. So there's, you know, there's more to it than simple gardening 101. It's also how to be an effective volunteer.
Sure. On the phone with Aaron LaFave, horticultural educator. That's for Eau Claire County, yes?
Eau Claire County Extension, yes.
And specifically the Eau Claire Area Master Gardeners. Brought home some awards from the International Conference. They are a testament, I would guess, to the health and vibrancy of the regional group. Tell us about the hardware you guys brought home.
Well, they actually got a nice certificate that they can keep. The International Conference was on an Alaskan cruise, actually, and nobody from our area was able to attend that conference. But we did send a poster, which they displayed there, and then later sent back these nice awards that we can keep.
And you won a what? Tell us about the Excellence Award.
They won the second place award for excellence in the presentation category, which would include things like the Winter Garden Seminar, which is what they put on. So they won second place for that, and it was probably out of applicants of about 10 or more.
Okay.
There was four categories, and they applied for the presentation category for their Winter Garden Seminar work. And that's where they won that second place award there.
I thought this had to do with volunteering.
Well, it does. I mean, they volunteer their time to make the Winter Garden Seminar. And the application detailed how they go about making the Winter Garden Seminar and all the volunteer hours that go into it, which is a lot and a lot of people. So their project was, their volunteer project, which is the Winter Garden Seminar, was awarded that.
Yeah, and I was curious because the release didn't say where the international conference was, but you just clarified that. So
It was a cruise. It's usually not a cruise, but it just happened to be a floating location.
Have you been able to go in the past?
I have not been to any of the International Master Gardener conferences. It's held every other year.
So Master Gardeners is widespread. Is it always applied by extension offices?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
It's in many different states. It's probably in just about every state in the country. And yes, it's completely affiliated with UW Extension. Yeah.
So now, can someone become a Master Gardener at any time, or do you have calls for membership?
We have calls for training. Sometimes I do them once a year. I've done them twice a year. Sometimes I don't do them at all during the year. Mm-hmm. People can take them, and other counties do them at different times. And sometimes if there isn't one training being done in a county at the time the person wants to take them, they can take them in an adjacent county, but also volunteer in their home county too. So it's okay to do training at other places at different times.
And you have a training solicitation out now, don't you?
Yes, we're going to do a training in 2014, and we're taking applications for that now.
Okay. I'll tell the people how to do that after we hang up. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Erin LaFave is the county horticultural educator. She can be reached via telephone at 715-839-4712, or you can email her at this address, erin.lafave, that's L-A-F-A-I-V-E, at co.o-claire.wi.us. The Master Gardeners Program, congratulations to the Eau Claire County Chapter for their award, and thanks for your volunteerism. Master Gardeners, give it a shot. I think it's going to grow on you. Spectrum Memo, Lynn Rothrock and the Mood Swingers play the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls Saturday evening at 7:30. Friday evening at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, it's Celtic harpist and storyteller Patrick Ball at 7:30. And then Saturday evening, it's Taste of the North, the 8th annual fundraiser featuring food and beverage artisans handpicked from western Wisconsin. What else? Saturday evening, the Minnesota Concert Opera visits the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, and that is at 7:30.
Support for WPR comes from the Girl Scouts of the Northwestern Great Lakes, dedicated to providing a foundation for lifelong leadership skills through innovative programming for girls grades K through 12. More at gsnwgl.org. Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering home mortgage applications online as well as information about the process, payment amounts, title insurance, mortgage insurance, and more. More at wisconsincu.org. And from Simply Dunn in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com.
Spectrum West, all about the arts, music, and culture of West Wisconsin. And a big part of our culture fabric is our inclination toward helping one another. Here's a segment that involves helping on a couple levels. We can help those who help others, thus indirectly helping as many people as we can. The Bridge to Hope in Menominee is a vital organization, supplying shelter, support, information, and referrals to people affected by domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. Thankfully, we may not personally be connected, but we can become very personally connected simply by helping maintain the existence of things like the Bridge to Hope. And Saturday, we can do just that. I talked with Bridge to Hope Service Coordinator Nicole Johnson. Within the mission statement of the Bridge to Hope, you use the word empower. You empower individuals, families, and communities. Tell me about the empowering process, would you please?
Sure. Well, basically what we do is we provide information and advocacy, and pretty much what that is saying is that we're trying to show that these men and women and kids can really make their own choices, make their own decisions, and really live the life that they want to live, which, you know, should be full of happiness and hope, and really having that power or find that power to live the way that they want to live. So kind of that empowerment is showing them that they have that within them to live that life that they want to without abuse, without feeling ashamed or any of those other stigmas that may come in society.
Yeah, even if they may have come from an environment of those things, they
Correct.
Still have the power to overcome that.
Correct, yes.
The concept upon which the Bridge to Hope was built is over 30 years old, having begun back in 1980. I think the current configuration, 1996, is that when you became who you are?
Yep, it was around that time that we actually became the Bridge to Hope, when we started actually receiving funding from the state and federally as well, and that we actually got a building, because before that it was pretty much run by volunteers in their own homes.
Uh-huh.
So now that we have a building, people can actually come here, and we have staffed advocates. And a shelter here as well.
Okay, so the physical plant is like what? Is it just offices? Is there?
It's actually an old house.
Okay.
So it's an old house, and the very the top of it is our shelter, and then we have office spaces. We have a kids' playroom, kitchen spaces on both the office levels, and just really it's a home environment, which I think is really important for the work that we do here.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes things really welcoming and really comfortable for everyone.
Mm-hmm. The three social maladies that I mentioned in reading your mission statement, domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. I mean, we know, we don't want to admit it all the time, but we know they're in our midst. We usually associate them, though, with seeing something on the news about it happening in some big city off in the distance. Sadly, it is right next door, isn't it? The human trafficking, that's the one that's hardest to grasp as far as being closer than we want it to be.
Yes, I think so.
Tell me about the prevalence of that. How often do you deal with that kind of thing?
I would say that a lot of people don't really know how to put a name with it either at this point. I think it is fortunate that it really has been in the news a lot recently, so the word is kind of traveling, that human trafficking is a real thing, and it's a form of slavery. But even when victims come to us, I don't think that they necessarily call themselves human trafficking victims. They'll say, you know, that I've been sexually assaulted or I have been physically, emotionally, verbally abused. So I would say that we definitely have had victims over the past who are human trafficking victims, yet they may not actually call themselves that yet at this point. And so the terminology, I think, is really important to kind of get out there as far as really using the words that we would use,
sure,
like pimps and, you know, things like that, because that's what they're doing to
sure.
men and women.
Okay, so these things exist, and thank goodness there are people and concerns like the Bridge to Hope. How are things, do you think, I mean, you weren't back at the beginning, I'm sure, in 1980, but how are things like the Bridge begun? Is it that someone just gets fed up, or they see a real need, or they get a group of people together and say, all right, we got to do something about this. Do you have any firsthand knowledge as to how you guys got started?
You know, I think a lot of it is still a little bit of a mystery, but we have actually kind of dug into that the last couple of years here, trying to figure out really where the roots began. And it was a group of women who had opened up their homes to victims, so they would actually house women and their families in their homes as volunteers, get them, bus tickets or whatever they needed to get out of that situation to actually go somewhere that was safe, whether it was with other family and friends or possibly another established agency that could actually help them. So it is actually a group of ladies that started doing that, and then once they actually started getting funding from the state through the West Central Domestic Abuse Project, that's when we actually started becoming an actual agency. But yeah, it was all completely volunteer-based at first, letting people in their home.
Uh-huh. Nicole Johnson, our guest services coordinator, The Bridge to Hope. I was reading in your summer newsletter about domestic abuse of men. That's bigger than one might think.
Yes, that is. And we've really kind of started going with that. Not very many places offer services to men at this point. It definitely is kind of something new that we're doing, and it's actually going really well.
Wow. All right. Well, let's transition to the lighter side of our topic, and that's the first ever quilt tour. Tell me about the genesis behind that, because it's a big, hopefully a big fundraiser for you.
Yeah, hopefully. So the quilt tour is, like you said, the first ever that we're doing. We usually do a big fundraiser in the fall, so this will be ours and the last one for the year here. And it's on Saturday, November 9th, so this Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Menominee. And basically what it is that it takes you on a tour to four different local churches where it will feature six local quilt clubs, and we'll be able to view all of their work. There'll be demonstrations, a lot of other displays as well, such as aprons, table runners, jackets, and there'll be bags for purchase as well, and there'll be a big raffle also.
Yeah, thank goodness for you that quilting is popular.
Yes.
As you said, six quilt groups. They all have kind of creative names, too, I was reading. That's
yeah, they do.
Well, good luck with that. It is Saturday, and it, again, as you said, is 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's at four different churches in Menominee. Do you want to name the churches so that people know where to go?
Absolutely. So it will take you to the First Congregational United Church of Christ, Cedarbrook Church, Our Savior's Lutheran Church, and St. Joseph's Catholic Church.
Yeah. Are there other amenities when they get there? Will they have little snacks and stuff, do you think?
Yep, there'll be snacks and coffee at each site. Mm-hmm. They can also actually purchase a quilt tour passport ticket at each of the sites for $10. They can actually purchase them in advance also at The Bridge or at La Di Da or Bookends on Main, both in Menominee downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll actually be a couple of cool demonstrations that'll be going on at a couple of the places as well. At Our Savior's Lutheran Church, they'll be making a memory quilt, and that'll be led by Beau Gabriel, and that's at 2 p.m. And then at St. Joe's, there'll actually be a demonstration at 10:30 on how to make yo-yos. And at 1 p.m., they will be showing how to make Chanel pot holders.
How to make yo-yos?
Yes.
Cool. I think everybody ought to have a yo-yo. That's the old way of keeping yourself busy. We weren't tweeting back then. We were just doing our yo-yos.
Right, right.
Yeah, cool. Well, I went to your website, and I noticed that two of the very important links, one is donate, and, of course, this quilt tour is in that fashion. The other one is volunteer. You can always use volunteers, right?
Absolutely.
Tell me what people could do to become a volunteer.
They can certainly contact us here at The Bridge and find out what kind of volunteering they would like to do, and we can try to match up their interests with what we kind of have needs for. Usually any sort of yard work, depending on the season, if it's helping with the snow or possibly the leaves, just kind of helping to clean and organize throughout our building is usually really helpful. And also childcare is usually pretty important as well, to kind of really have some of that playtime with the kids and giving some of the parents a break as well to kind of work on some of their goals. So a lot of those are some typical volunteer opportunities.
Good deal. And I hope people come out of the woodwork to not only volunteer, but I know they will for your quilt tour. Congratulations. All the best. All the best on what you guys do, and keep up the good work.
Great. Thank you.
Bridge to Hope. Good name, good organization, and this weekend, good cause. Again, the first ever quilt tour is Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at four Menominee Church locations. The website is thebridgetohope.org. Well, it's the big show featuring hip-hop artist Kid Ink and opening act Starbound at the Zorn Arena. Doors open at 7:30 Saturday evening on the UW Eau Claire campus. Tickets at the Service Center or online. The Artist Series at UW Eau Claire presents the James Sewell Ballet next Wednesday the 13th at the Zorn Arena, and that is at 7:30.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. Almost Maine plays through Saturday at Harvey Hall Theater on the University of Wisconsin Stout campus in Menominee. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present The Diary of Anne Frank through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Blues Clues, The Most Spectacular Place, will play through Sunday at the Eau Claire Children's Theater's Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Theater in the Woods will present The Odd Couple Friday through Sunday at the Erica Kwan Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. Escanaba in the Moonlight, a production of the Neillsville Area Players, runs through Sunday at the Neillsville Area High School. White Christmas will play Fridays and Saturdays at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show runs through December 1st. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Spectrum West on a Thursday, November 7th. Or you could be listening at our rebroadcast Friday evening at 7 p.m. If you are, thanks. And you know, I say while we have them all warmed up, let's not let Jim Oliver get away. Let's get more of his conversational style within a report on yet another curtain call waiting to happen in our resourceful neighborhood.
Almost Maine is a play by John Cariani. It premiered in Portland, Maine in 2004 and had a brief off-Broadway run in New York in 2006. A New York Times review of a production earlier this year said, "This is a beautifully structured play with nifty surprise endings, most but not all of them happy." Well, the University of Wisconsin Stout Theater will stage Almost Maine through Saturday in the Harvey Hall Theater on the university campus in Menominee. Joining us is Paul Kallenberg of the University Theater, director of the show. So, Mr. Kallenberg, thanks so much for coming on with us. What's the play about?
The play is, I call it a comic winter's tale about life, love, and lights. And it explores eight different scenarios of a romantic couple and how their experience and their state of their relationship is at the present time. So it's basically eight little plays within the context of one play, and it's telling the stories of these individuals as they explore their life and their what I call their romantic identity.
Now, according to the Almost Maine website, it is now one of the most produced plays in the country, and recently supplanted Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, particularly in North American high schools. So what's so appealing about the play that attracts theater companies and, I presume, audiences?
Well, I think it deals with one of the most common things that we all experience, and that is relationships with other people, be it they on a relationship level or a romantic relationship level that the play takes it to. So it's something that everyone can relate to. We all have experiences in romantic relationships, or we yearn for them, and so of all the eight different stories, there's always something that the audience is going to be able to identify with in terms of something that they have experienced in the past or have seen other loved ones experience. So it really speaks to a broad audience. So I think that's one of the reasons that it is so popular. And no matter what age level you are, you're always dealing with relationships and your first date or as it matures through time. And so it speaks to a wide audience.
You know, I was just thinking as we were talking that I looked at the Dramatist Play Service that distributes plays and scripts and so forth and so on. And in their promotional material for it, it said characters are two men and two women. I assume it's a play then that can either be four people playing all these different roles, or you can cast more people in the roles. Is that the way this thing
right
works?
It's very versatile that way, because there are the eight little vignettes that take place. So it was first written and produced with four actors, We have 11 actors playing multiple roles. So some of them play three roles, some play two roles, and some play one role. So I kind of let the audition process determine how many people we're going to cast in terms of who fit what character the best.
What is Almost Maine, by the way?
Almost Maine is a fictional town in Maine that it's an unorganized territory, and it's not on any map, and it is just a small little burg up in northern Maine that by the time you stumbled into it, you'd be stumbling out of it.
I was just wondering, is that is the culture of Maine can be somewhat unique in its own way. Does the play reflect that, or is the play pretty much universal in nature?
Well, it's definitely universal, but it certainly has the flavor of that northern Maine experience and the folks who live up in the vast wilderness and are very secluded and have their own little quirks and whimsies that people in towns like that have. To me, it's very much for those who know the television series Northern Exposure back in, I don't know what decade that was, but I watched Northern Exposure a lot when it was out, and it's very much the quirky inhabitants. Northern Exposure is a small town in Alaska that it takes place in, and this is very much the same type of feel.
Now, you mentioned there are, would you say, 11 actors playing in the play.
Correct.
What about the technical staff? Are there professionals as well as students involved there as well?
Our faculty scenic and lighting designer is Beth Janetsky, and she also does the technical directing. And under her supervision, we have student sound designer, and we have student crew members and student crews working on building the set and the costumes and running the fly system and things of that nature during the performances.
He is Paul Kallenberg, who is director of the UW Stout Theater production of Almost Maine. Well, how are students selected for roles in the play?
Well, we hold open auditions, and at Stout, auditions are open to the entire campus. And so we get a large, a wide variety of students who have been interested in theater, or maybe did it in high school or at the community level, and get a wide variety. So it's open to all the students, and they come and I give them monologues to perform. And from that first set of auditions, then I narrow it down to a specific group that I'm most interested in. And then we do another set of auditions where we read materials from the specific play that we are producing, and then I choose the cast from that group.
So what's coming up at the University Theater?
Our spring production will be the musical 110 in the Shade, and that is going to be performed over at the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. Harvey Hall, the building Harvey Hall on campus, is going under a renovation, and so the next three shows that we produce will be performed over in the Mabel Tainter because the entire building has to be closed down. So we'll be performing the musical 110 in the Shade over there.
You know, you mentioned musical. I forgot to ask. I was reading there is some musical interludes played between these vignettes. Are those very specific, or is it music that you select yourself?
It's music that I selected myself.
Mm-hmm. How do you select plays for the University Theater?
Oh, one of the things that I always take into consideration is the students who are involved in the theater program and what might best suit their capabilities. And that's one of the reasons I chose Almost Maine, is that I felt that the group that we have would be really be able to handle the material, and especially the comedy of it. And comedy is very hard to play sometimes. A lot of times people think that the serious dramas are so difficult to act, and the comedy really requires a lot of exact timing and precision and line delivery and physicality. And so it also really has a lot of challenges for the students in terms of acting this type of comic style. And we haven't done a comedy for a while, so I wanted to balance off some of the more serious things that we've been doing over the last year and bring a little bit lightheartedness back into the theater.
Well, the play is Almost Maine, a production of the UW Stout Theater. And the show runs through Saturday at the Harvey Hall Theater on the university campus in Menominee. Tickets are available through the University Box Office. Paul Kallenberg, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Jim Oliver, who volunteers his time to help make Wisconsin Public Radio as good as it can be. If we haven't already, we should publish his photograph on the Spectrum West WPR link, so if you run into him, you can say thanks. You might notice he has a new bounce in his step. This is Spectrum West. We appreciate you being along for the ride today.
Support for WPR comes from historic downtown Spooner, offering Northland furniture, pubs, movie theaters, and more. Maps, events, and information at shopspooner.com. Eat, shop, play. Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company.
His name is Mr. Rogers, a name which immediately sends waves of calm through one's being upon hearing it. But after further review, it's actually Dr. Rogers, Ogden Rogers, professor and chair of the Department of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. In addition to his competency as an educator, he also has a knack for storytelling. Using it in the classroom, he's now taken that knack and turned it into a book, Beginnings, Middles, and Ends, Sideways Stories on the Art and Soul of Social Work. He feels it's a bit arrogant to write a book like this because he sees it mostly as one man's loquaciousness. But once you dive into this pool of words, you find it to be just the right temperature and discover it has both a shallow end and a deep end. When all is said and done, it's a very good book. It entertains, it teaches, it amazes, it warms, it adds conditioner to the human condition. I have the book in my hand, and here is one of the 99 stories and passages. This is called Principle of Opposites. I've read thousands of pages of books and articles of being helpful to persons in crisis and disaster. Here's what I got from all that reading. Intervening in crisis requires one to stay calm and be focused on basic needs. If cold, add warm. If wet, add dry. If hard, add soft. If dark, add light. If hungry, add food. If thirsty, add water. If homeless, add shelter. If naked, add clothes. If lost, add orientation. If hopeless, add hope. If crowded, add space. If isolated, add people. It's not really rocket science, but you'd be surprised how well it works. Walk into the middle of a crisis, stay calm, and apply the principle of opposites, and people will think you are a genius. Let's slip into the world of Ogden Rogers by first getting a definition we may take for granted, but not really know. Define social work. It might be real broad, and it might take up our whole interview, but what does it entail? Can you do it in a nutshell?
Social work is the professional activity of trying to make the world better.
well, we all do that, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's many ways to be helpful in the world. I think social workers work in so many different kinds of places, but generally we all share kind of the same ways of looking at people and kind of looking at problem solving. And I mean, I often say that we have sort of a bifocal vision. We're about helping individuals kind of facilitate their challenges and the strengths that they have with larger systems, helping people sort of adapt to the larger environment around them. But at the same time, we've always been a profession that's been about trying to work with large systems to make them more responsive and adaptive to people's individual needs. So, you know, you have some social workers who will literally spend, you know, like a classic 50-minute hour in some sort of counseling situation with somebody. But then you've got other social workers who spend their entire lives, like, helping to organize communities and develop policies and programs.
Uh-huh.
We've got a big portfolio.
What I like about it is that you guys haven't given in to all the pretentiousness that's out there today by saying, you know, we should call ourselves something more glamorous than social workers. by continuing to call yourselves social workers, it's like you're in a bee colony. You know, you just have.
Well, I think we've always been a profession of empowerment. I mean, we always have a focus on working with people wherever they're at. I think we have a particular affinity toward helping working with families and children, and particularly working with people who are marginalized either by economic situations or poverty, or marginalized by, you know, issues of social injustice, discrimination, and prejudice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, nobody's ever going to get rich working with the rich as a social worker.
You know, in the book's introduction, you use the phrase, the crazy quilt of my social work life. So I think you've kind of described that. That's the diversity. Is it the diversity, you think, that makes it so interesting and satisfying?
I think one of the, as a profession, one of the benefits of the profession is the ability to move into so many different kinds of career environments. In my life, I've done that 50-minute hour.
Uh-huh.
But I've also been at, you know, the international level table meeting, helping people organize, you know, major policy decisions that could affect life and death.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same basic set of professional values and activities that allow me to do that. And by the way, I think most of my colleagues enjoy careers where you get to kind of go lots of different places in your career, and that for me is actually one of the benefits of a social work life. Don't get me wrong, I love accountants. I have an accountant. He saves my life every year. But I could never do that job.
Yeah. Yeah, you and me both there. You work with other professionals, mental health professionals. There was one story that I was reading in which you were kind of working arm in arm with a psychiatrist. Maybe there's more stories that have that working relationship. So let's say that you are working to assess someone. We kind of know what the psychiatrist does. Mm-hmm. How would you work hand in hand in that case?
Social workers rarely do their work all by themselves. We're often the profession that's kind of like the grease between lots of wheels.
Ah, okay.
And so one of the things, you know, the psychiatrist may have a strong orientation toward making a diagnosis and perhaps maybe even prescribing medications mm-hmm. that might help ameliorate symptoms. The social worker involved with the behavioral health team might be the person who's also gone out to the patient's house and visited the patient's family and gathered information about the patient's job and how he's doing there. We're a profession that's very comfortable with jumping over boundaries. While some people may do all their activity within an office, we have offices, but we're also pretty comfortable jumping onto the street or jumping into the workplace or visiting the school and getting that extra social perspective on a client's needs.
Uh-huh. Our guest is Dr. Ogden Rogers, professor and chair of social work, the department at UW River Falls. His book is Beginnings, Middles, and Ends, Sideways Stories on the Art and Soul of Social Work. I'll dive to the book in just a second, but I have one more question about the educator part.
Sure.
How long does it take to recognize a good social worker in a student?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question.
Can you immediately sense something?
Well, our program here at UW River Falls is an undergraduate program.
Okay.
So most of the people that I meet in as a student are pretty much what I would call traditionally aged young people. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I see a lot of growth in people over 4 years, you know. Someone
sure.
who comes in at 18 and leaves at 21 or 22 really can do an awful lot of changing. You know, I'd be a liar if I said, oh, yeah, you can recognize a good social worker just from Jump Street.
Okay.
Because I've just seen some people who I thought at first were you know, oh, geez, I don't know that this student's going to be able to do it. But, boy, 4 years later, they've proven me wrong.
What are the ingredients? I mean, there's got to be some compassion in there. But, you know, you keep using the word assessment in the book. They have to be critical thinkers and have the ability to see things maybe in a way others don't.
Compassion is the first necessary ingredient, but it's not sufficient.
Okay.
I mean, the world is filled with stories of people who had great hearts and who wanted to be helpful, and turned things into terrible tragedies. Wanting to be helpful is the first requirement, but learning how to use your mind and use yourself in reasoned ways, being a good critical thinker, being able to apply an informed knowledge base, you know, either about human behavior, sure, or social behavior or political behavior is also necessary. So you've got to have a really, really good heart, but you also have to have a really, really strong development in your thinking.
I would guess that maybe recognizing that line between letting the emotional side get a little too involved.
That's actually what we call learning a sense of professional boundary.
Okay.
We spend a lot of time on that. If I allowed my emotions to just lay on my sleeve, boy, there's a lot of people who I never would have been able to help.
Yeah. The second, the subtitle of your book is Sideways Stories on the Art and Soul of Social Work. Of course, the familiar phrase is heart and soul. You've taken it to art and soul. And I think you've already described what the art and soul of social work is, although maybe we should probably touch on the art to it.
Well, you know, clearly all of the professions in our country are built on having a good, you know, scientific basis. But, you know, if you really think about it, you know, the good physician is also the person who's a really good listener and knows how to take that extra step in developing a relationship with you. The good social worker is also that kind of person. You have to develop your use of self so that people can be comfortable with you, and yet at the same time be able to use you as a person who can, you know, help them get out of a spot that they're probably in.
Yeah. I'm holding the book in my hands, and I have some Post-it notes that are stuck to some of the pages. The sideways part of it, I guess I didn't really ever think, or maybe nobody described to me what a sideways story is, but it's fun to discover. And there's actually a whole bunch of sideways involved in the production of this book, because you found many of these stories and notes while you were looking for something else, didn't you?
You know, I began, it's kind of funny, is that I never ever really thought about finishing this book. I began writing it because I got a letter one day from an old college instructor who had, in his work, where he was now working in hospice, he remembered a story that I had written for a class for him years and years and years ago, and that story had played a role in his own thinking and working with people who were dying.
Mm.
And I was so sort of impressed with the idea that something that I had written 40 years ago as a young man was influencing the work of this, you know, very integral professional. And it led me to thinking that it's like, well, wow, you know, we all have stories. I've been telling stories for years. Stories are fundamentally one of the most powerful ways of human communication, and I thought to myself, you know, well, I may not be on this mortal coil for all that long. Maybe I should start writing my stories down before I pass along. Because actually, that was what my first story was that this man was talking about. It was a story about listening to another man's stories. And then one day, the man died, and I sort of reflected on the fact that, and with him went all his stories. So for me, my own sideways story was writing this book as a way of having a sense of generativity about the things I've learned in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I can do this book justice within the 10 or 15 minutes we have allotted for an interview.
Sure.
So I'm going to urge people to just get the book because you have to. It's such a wonderful roller coaster ride. I mean, there's one called A Damn Good Question.
And these are the real short ones. There's one called Proper Noun, and they kind of make you sit back and say, whoa, okay, well, let me just digest that for a minute.
You know, between you and me, and now your listeners as well, I actually call those stories potato chips.
Cool, yeah, that's a good, I can see how they'd be called.
Because you just, you know, oh, I liked that, but now I want to eat another.
Yeah, and so you have short ones, and then you have humorous ones. Then you have ones that kind of combine humor and poignancy, like Paging Jesus. And then you get to the tough ones. You know, you have a real short one called DNKA, Did Not Keep Appointment. And then you have one which, to me, and as I admitted earlier, I have not been able to read the entire book yet, but the one that just kind of made me say, man, this guy has got a shovel. He can dig deep on this now. Killing Brendan. What an interesting take on something that was. And that's the one that when people get the book, that's the one I think they should go to and read first, because you read it and you go, hey, and then you get to the point where you say, I was instantly pulled into the consciousness that I also had the power not to act, which is, that's...
For me, that was a very important and deep moment in my life. I had the, in a very fraction of a second, I had the consciousness of my own horror, but also my own freedom.
Yeah, the psychological impact of that particular story is cool because it teaches people, not necessarily to look on the bright side, but it teaches them to learn something from what they're going through and say, okay, there is a lesson here.
Absolutely. And cool. I guess the other thing is that, you know, for people who would read the book who would be like social workers or social work students, I wanted to also model for them the idea that there's no real difference between ourselves and the struggles that our clients have.
Yep. Yeah, and it's important for us to notice the signposts that are within all of the things that happen to us on a daily basis.
Our lives are filled with all sorts of good stories.
Do you consider this kind of a textbook? I think somewhere on the back maybe it said non-traditional, but it could be, I suppose. And is this required reading for your students now?
No, I would never call this a textbook. I don't really know what to say about this book, except that...
And you've also, excuse me for interrupting, but at one point you apologized for writing this book.
I know, I did. Sometimes we've all also had to listen to stories that went on for way too long and wish we hadn't. This book was written because, you know, as an educator and living every day with students, there are so many textbooks that I know my students have to read. And don't get me wrong, that's all very important. But to get my take on literally the art and soul of what it is that we needed to do, I wanted people to have an opportunity to just have some moments of good reading that they could reflect upon.
And it is good reading. In fact,
it's
great reading. You had the luxury, and maybe you've had more than one, but you had a quotable mentor along the way. Some of us have had a mentor or mentors. Tell us just a little bit about Hannah. Is that the person you alluded to earlier?
One of the sections of the book, or one of the chapters, I guess, of the book is a section I call The Dialogues of Hannah. And that's a collection of stories that really do sort of reflect on the mentor-mentee relationship, which I think is a precious moment in everyone's life if you can have a good mentor.
Yeah, and Hannah is a male.
That's the question, isn't it?
No, well, I think you say he every once in a while.
Do I?
I think at one point you say he.
Then I've outed it.
I kept saying, well, who's Hannah? Holy Hannah.
You know? Who is Hannah?
Yeah. Well, where can we get the book? That's a good question. How do we get a hold of it? Because I have mine, but other people have to get theirs. And
well, I mean, it's available on all the major outlets, Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. You know, we live in such a social media world where we can access our literature and art.
Yeah.
It's also on Google Books. Is also available through the publisher, which is White Hat Communications. All of those are pretty much easily accessible over the internet.
Let me say this. Even if social work is the last thing on your mind, and I'm talking to listeners here, this book will take you to a place of appreciation for those who do social work, and I think it'll provide some very enlightening moments, most of which are relative to who we are and how we live. So congratulations on a good book. And
thanks so much.
Mr. Rogers, that's got to be a padding to you walking into a room and saying, hi, I'm Mr. Rogers.
You know, I love to wear sneakers and sweaters.
I'll bet you look great in them. Doctor, I'll give you that. Ogden Rogers, thanks for being with us here on Spectrum West. I appreciate it.
That's terrific. Thanks so much for having me.
A little earlier, I alluded to a piece from the book called Proper Noun. It's very short. Here it is. No, she corrected me, I'm not a schizophrenic. I have schizophrenia. It affects my thoughts, my moods, my behaviors, but it is not me. It's a disease, she said, not a definition. The book is Beginnings, Middles, and Ends, Sideways Stories on the Art and Soul of Social Work, but don't let the title fool you, it's more than that. And it's fun to read. Spectrum Memos, the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra returns to the Wisconsin Canoe Heritage Museum in Spooner Saturday. Complimentary wine, hors d'oeuvres, and museum tours beginning at 6 p.m. The symphony strikes their first notes at 7. It's an exhibit featuring artwork by Sister Christine Haugen, The Desert's Blooms, yes, up through November 12th at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. The documentary, A Place at the Table, One Nation Under Fed, will be shown in Eau Claire Tuesday, November 12th. 6 p.m. at the Eau Claire County Extension Office. That is in Altoona. Admission is free. You can reserve a seat by calling 839-4712. Writers Read, coming back to the L.A. Phillips Public Library in Eau Claire Tuesday evening the 12th. Saturday at the Wide Spot in Stockholm, an evening with Wisconsin Poet Laureate Max Garland. That's at 7 p.m. The Singing Statesman, Friday evening at 7:30. The Honor Band, Wind Symphony, and Symphony Band, Saturday at 7. University Symphony Orchestra, Sunday at 2. The Concert Choir, Sunday at 5. All at Gantner Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And the Rad Jazz Series at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, presents Stolen Moments, the music of Oliver Nelson, Saturday, 7:30. Abbott Concert Hall, Kleinpel Fine Arts Building. Wow, as usual, lots going on in West Wisconsin. Thanks, Rachel Vick. Thanks, Tiffany Coggins. Thank you for allowing us to spend part of your day. Next week, we've got books about baseball as played on West Wisconsin Diamonds. We have comedy, we have music, and a lot more. I'm Al Ross. This has been Spectrum West. Thanks for being with us. We'll do it again next Thursday and repeat it on Friday. Have a great weekend.